Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. So glad you could attend. It's so beautiful to sit together with you all day after day. Whatever struggles or joys we all might be going through. We just continue together. A very unique thing. We're a very small percentage of Santa Cruz here in the Sesshin, as you can see. Are we the crazy ones, or are they all the crazy ones? Missing out on such an opportunity. Well, I didn't get to any personal stories yesterday, and if I start talking about meditation, chances are unlikely it would happen. So I better start with one. Keep some people awake. How about some stories of life at No Abode Hermitage?
For a little bit, we've been to various places, but I think very few of us actually have like an idea of like what goes on at No Abode. It's like this, nobody really knows.
Yeah, I've long wondered myself. This is maybe the closest thing I'll end up doing in this lifetime to something like a 3-year retreat. Maybe not, but once upon a time, there was about 12, 13, 14 years ago, there was some of us who'd been living at Tassajara, the monastery, for some years, and watched ourselves going through that cycle of the fall and winter practice periods, which is very much like our life here this week. And then the season would change, the guest season. It would go from a life of mostly silence, mostly centered around zazen, to a life of lots of activity and not much zazen. And depending on one's role, and very active, beautiful practice in its own way, serving many, many beings. I think you all kind of know how this works at Tassajara. It's symbolized, I think it's very much epitomized by a ceremony that's done at the beginning and end of the winter, the beginning and end of the summer, of closing the gate and opening the gate. There's a big mountain gate, and at the end of the summer, there's a ceremony. While chanting the Heart Sutra, people swing the giant gates closed, and shunk, but close the bar across the gate, and dedicate the sort of like, I think, dedicating the merit of the summer to all the people who have come and practiced and helped there. Maybe it's more just like, it's reading a list of names of, I think, everybody who's come through and stayed there working in the summer. It takes like 15 minutes just to read this long list. And then it gets very quiet. At the end of the winter, chant the Heart Sutra pull that bar across, swing the gates open, let it in. So some of us, you know, had gone through that cycle of the gate opening and closing a few times and feeling like, although we enjoy both modes of practice, there's something so unique, really unique, about that mode of practice period, that life of zazen and silence. And sometimes we feel like after half a year, we'd just be starting to build up some steam, and then the gates would open again. And something would feel as if it was lost. So we thought, what if we just had a, what if we try an experiment of finding a small place, small, simple way to try such an experiment and just kind of stay in that mode of practice period throughout the year. And we had various ideas of how to do that and where to do that. And I remember there's some meetings we had in practice period of some of us kind of spread the word, like, we're thinking of trying to do this kind of thing. If anyone's interested, let's come to the meeting and let's talk about it. And lots of people showed up. I think it was like maybe 15 people or so. I totally want to do that. Sign me up. I'm on board. These were people who were like, we had a few meetings and like started describing it and like, are you serious about it? Would you really be into it? Like embarking on such a unknown adventure. And yeah, maybe it was maybe 10 people in the end were like, yeah, sign me up. I'm on board. And so then as it progressed, causes and conditions were such that that there was one very devoted student of Tenshin Roshi, my teacher, who felt like he should have like a place like that. He should have like a little monastery where he could practice with a small group of people who wanted to live that way. And she had the means, so she's all, you know, I'll buy you a monastery. And so then after Tassajara, some of us went out and we wanted somewhere near Green Gulch where he lives so that he could live at Green Gulch and have this, like, this kind of side project. So we looked around Muir Beach, which was the obvious place, very close by. And, you know, we're like, it's time to do this. Let's do it now. So we're not going to, you know, whatever's on the market. So there was his house for sale. It's on Friars Lane, appropriately. And just, you know, maybe an 8-minute drive from Green Gulch, 1-hour walk in the other direction. And some of us found that place. We brought Tenshin Roshi, and he I think he maybe looked at some others first, and when he saw that one, he said, yeah, this looks like it. And I remember that it was being shown. I think the owners were maybe still living there. It was still furnished, and they were kind of like some spiritual types. I don't know what their practice was, but they had a lot of like Tibetan Tonka paintings on the walls. And when going to see it, they had incense lit in different rooms, and Buddhist statues around. Like, interesting flavor of this place. auspicious. So that place was bought, and then, but when we came time to move in, it was completely empty. There was no more furniture and no more of those Buddhist paintings. That was all gone, of course. An empty shell. And we had the plan, and we told these maybe 10 people interested. This is all like, you know, it's a pretty long time ago, so this is my memory. But we said, okay, we're on. We got the place. We're ready to go. You know, when will you be coming? You're still interested? And by the way, as I think we had talked about before, we're just reminding you now that because, you know, this place was offered, but there's no other support, there will be, you know, of course, there'd be no stipend or health insurance and no means of support. And we want to really set it up like a pretty strict monastic schedule. It was Zazen beginning at 4 a.m., so even a little earlier than Tassajara, ending at 9 p.m. every day. I think it was, I think we had like 8 periods of Zazen a day. We tried different schedules, but that was outside of Sesshin. Then Sesshin, maybe we boosted up to 12 or so. And So all those people who were so interested, when they started thinking about realistically what it involved, like, I think I'd maybe just stay at Tassajara. Thanks. It's too risky. It's too unknown. It's totally undependable. Here at Tassajara, we get, I think health insurance and stipend are kind of a, you know, make it really sustainable. I think really wonderful that San Francisco Zen Center can offer that, because you can live there for many years and come out with some savings even at the end. But this was just jumping into who knows what. So in the end, it was just me and one other person. Okay, let's do it. And we decided, let's really, let's just try to like live really, really simply. This was someone, a priest named Chusan, who had lived in India for some years and was used to living in a little hut in India, long-term practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism, where they have a important retreat practice. So we're like, let's just go and just start sitting, basically, and we'll see what comes. And so I remember at first, for a while, we just had plastic forks and spoons from like, you know, from McDonald's or wherever that we happened to get. We didn't actually have like kitchen utensils or anything. It was really like an empty place, and we did get zafus and zabutons. I think that was the only thing, and I think we had a small bell. And gradually other stuff came, like we got the bigger bells and mokugyo, and we over the course of, so it was 3.5 years that I lived there. We built lots of altars. We had so much fun building, making it into a temple, basically, very gradually. We built study tables for sitting and studying. And, but we didn't, there still isn't any other furniture there. It's not. We have futons to sleep on, more like double zabutons. This kind of futon, long zabutons, kind of things. And we had a men's dorm and a women's dorm where the two upstairs bedrooms, and it just basically, sometimes we would switch them back and forth, but they always just stayed that way, so no one had a private space. And we had a study room downstairs, and we had the teacher's room, kind of symbolically, because Tenzin Roshi almost never came once it started, even though that was the whole design of it. That was why we got this big place in Mill Valley for like 10 times as much as it would cost anywhere else, so we're right nearby. But during those years, he rarely came. He's just like, oh, you guys are just doing it. You don't need my help. And we would go there to Green Gulch and for Doka-san and classes and so on. We could walk down the road, and we eventually blazed the trail into the trails that connect to Green Gulch. It's the closest building to Green Gulch towards town. It's at the end of the street, so it's all just woods and trails between. And we would we'd have these three practice periods of 3 months each, so like a fall, a winter, and a summer, where it was like that kind of around eight periods of zazen a day. And then in between those three, there were 3 1-month intervals, right? So that was the yearly cycle. I think the whole 3.5 years, we just kept to that. And we'd also have, during the practice periods, so that was 9 months of the year, we would have a 7-day sesshin each month. So that's like 9 times. So about 30 7-day sesshins we had in those 3 years. So sometimes I remember once we decided, let's just double it. Let's do a 2-week sesshin. I think just once we did that. It was, somewhat like this feeling, but even smaller. If you're used to Green Gulch or Tassajara, this feels very small, intimate, to sit with this small group like this. But there it was like usually from, 1 to 5 people doing sesshin. And living there. 1 to 4 people living there. So sometimes people would drop in for sesshin. People could come and live there. It was wonderfully just like permeable. It was very open. It was just like we had the space, and we couldn't offer anything except just a place to stay and zazen. And but anyone could come and stay, and there wasn't any cost or anything. It was kind of known. People didn't know about it often because it was just word of mouth. We didn't have a website or advertise. We didn't have an internet or radio or TV or anything. I think when the 9/11 World Trade Center thing was that 2001, and that happened when I was at Nobo, and we didn't find out till several days later. We just had no idea. We were like pretty cut off from what was happening in the world, even though we'd go to Green Gulch. I guess we didn't go for... That was probably when we found out. And it was... For me, it was like a beautiful life. I mean, it was like my dream come true. Like, this is what we had wanted to do, and we were doing it, and it had its own difficulties, but... And, of course, life has its own difficulties and struggles, but for me, it was like... There were times when I was totally dissatisfied. But it's interesting because for me it was like the perfect practice situation. So before in my life, all my dissatisfaction I could blame on the practice situation. Practice is not quite right. These people are not quite, it could be set up differently. That's the problem. This is like, we just set it up exactly like we wanted. when discontent arose, I could see it's totally, it always was, but now it's very obvious. It's just me, it's just my mind, because look how this is. And then there were other times when I felt like my heart would just be like singing it for no particular reason. I remember just times like in the summer, because we wouldn't turn on the heat in the winter, so I'd get like really down to freezing, and just the winters were a little bit bitter. And then the spring would come and we'd eat outside sometimes and on the deck in the sun, and just feeling like this leisure, this space of just like, this is, there's nothing to do but just let go of everything, and it's like a pure land. Sometimes I just feel like I have no complaints about this life. I was still in a kind of seeking and striving mode, so that kept me from enjoying it as fully as I might have. We gotta stay on the ball. We gotta maybe like turn up the volume a little bit, tighten up the forms a little and the schedule a little stricter. I think people were sometimes surprised. People would come and like, really? There's just like a free practice place where you can just come and stay and like hang out in the spiritual community? Like, yeah, here's the schedule and here's the forms. And so people who were very enthusiastic at first, after like a few days, would be like, well, you know, I'm coming for a month, okay? We're like, yeah, you can come for a month. And then after like a few days, they'd be like, something's coming up. I think I gotta go. Several times that happened. Sometimes people would come and stay just for sesshin. Y'all maybe know Bill Powell, who practices here. He likes to come and sit throughout the day. Sometimes even during zazen periods. That's how I think I met him. He used to come for many, many of those sesshins. He was kind of itinerant house sitter, back and forth between Santa Cruz and Marin, and somehow he got wind of our kind of schedule, and he'd show up when sesshin would begin, and then we'd go into total silence, so we never really got to talk with him, and he'd usually leave the next day. Many sesshins he came. Yes?
Food?
Oh yeah, so food. At the beginning, at the very beginning, we thought, well, realistically, we're like, how are we going to work this? We don't really have any means of support. We just have the place. And there was, like, I think, a little fund from the donor for repairs and so on. But the place was in pretty good condition. So we're like, lodging is really complete. But, and health insurance, let's just stay healthy. But we do need food. It does seem like that. And if we're going to stay here long term, we can't just spend what we have. We'll just run out of it. So, and in fact, this was a time in my practice when, even before then, I was living in Tassajara, and I kept hearing about Shakyamuni Buddha and the ancestors, and I just thought, it's so beautiful, an example of the simplicity of this life. I just want to live this way. I mean, I'm already kind of living this way at Tassajara, but I didn't have much money or savings. But I thought, let's take up the practice of the Buddhist monastic precepts. The traditional 250 precepts that are still in Theravada countries of practice, and in Mahayana countries except for Japan, the monks technically, you know, have these precepts, but they don't maybe follow so literally. But I had some connection with the Theravada monks, who I saw how their lifestyle worked, and they really pay attention to all maybe they have 227 in Theravada tradition. I'm like, let's, you know, a lot of them just naturally fall into place anyway, but let's really, again, more like an experiment. I thought of it like, this is an experiment. Let's try to live this way like the Buddha in terms of this conduct that sets up the lifestyle. Let's see what it does, see how it works. So part of that was not using money at all. So when I was still at Asahara, the little savings I had, I gave away to people there, and if people tried to give me monetary offerings, I can't receive other things. And that was an interesting experiment, very interesting. So I actually, for I think 4 years or more, I never even put quarters into parking meters or anything. Like, literally didn't use money or checks or credit card. And that didn't have any in the bank waiting for the end of the experiment either. It was just like zero. And even outside of a monastery context where it's where the monastery takes care of you, I didn't even have that. And yet, it works completely fine. It's just like, that was what I learned from that experiment, is like, I was healthy, happy, and fulfilled. Completely. I mean, my life was quite simple. During those 4 years, there were a lot of things that I do now that I didn't do then. Maybe, you know, during those 4 years, I maybe went to restaurants like a handful of times, maybe with my parents. I think maybe I saw like one movie in 4 years. When somebody took me. So it was, I think that's part of the idea of why the Buddha set that up, is like, if you really want to just focus on the simplicity of the present moment, you just don't even have to worry about all the worry that comes with finances and so on. So partly because I actually didn't have any money to buy food, and partly we thought we, even as a temple, if we want to sustain this, let's just make the commitment again as an experiment at the very beginning. Let's just say we won't buy any food. We'll maybe have to do other repairs, and there's like utilities, and maybe we'll have to deal with this. But food's a big expense. We won't spend any money. Even if money is given to us, we won't go to a store and buy food. And in fact, it worked. For 3.5 years, we never bought food. And so we're like, how will we eat? So we're like, well, In this Vinaya, in this monastic precepts, the monks didn't have money, but they ate every day, and they would just receive what came to them. And if they were living out in the forest, people often wouldn't go out in the forest, so they had to go into town with their bowl and see if anything came. So, and this is a practice that's carried on in Japan, from olden times to modern times, takuhatsu. Takuhatsu means to carry the bowl. And I think taku can also have this other meaning of entrust. So it's carrying the bowl, but also entrusting oneself to the bowl, entrusting one's life to what comes. So it's a practice of just like, I don't know if exactly the receptive samadhi, but it's the practice of just, like in Zazen, we just receive what comes to us. It's the physical practice of, we will just receive what comes. And sometimes they call it begging. I don't think it's quite begging, because begging is like you're pleading or you're asking for something. So it's quite clear in the monastic precepts that the monks can never ask. You never say, by the way, do you have something? That's what makes it different than going up to people and asking. So it's more like you just make yourself available, because otherwise people might not know. And then people can give if they want. So we would, once a week for those years, we would do in a very traditional way of the Japanese Zen style, where you have a large bamboo hat, rain and sun hat, and it's partly so you're like, it's like horse blinders. It's like it comes down like about this far, so your peripheral vision is like this circle. It's like Kinyan, you know. So you can, of course, look up, but the kind of the idea is partly so you're in the zazen mode, and so you're not getting all caught up in the things of the world as you're walking about town, and so you're also kind of anonymous, that people aren't giving to you as an individual person, they're just giving to the Sangha. That's how it's understood in Japan. And I think there's that feeling, yeah. And there's special cloth, almost like sort of gloves and leggings, and we got and made these things, and straw sandals, where you're woven out of rice straw, and then your orioki bowl that you use for your orioki meals. You're like, that's your bowl, so you take that into town, and you have it's quite small, so you also have a bag to put other things in, and you wear your robes. And you're presenting yourself as a practitioner of some kind. People might not know exactly what. So it took about an hour to walk, very beautiful, through the woods. Right across the street from No Abode, you go into the woods, and it comes out, this network of trails comes out right near Whole Foods in Mill Valley. So that was one of our main places. It's a little bit different from Japan because this is a kind of new thing in our culture, but it's not that new. We found the people, you know, in California, Mill Valley and Santa Cruz and places, people already know what this is. 20 years ago, I think it would have maybe been inconceivable, but Spirit Rock is close by in Mill Valley. And they have Theravada monks there all the time. So people, oh, you're on alms round. How can we support you? So we'd stand on the sidewalk. It's not really appropriate, I think, to stand on private property. So we'd stand on the public sidewalk near Whole Foods, and people would, as they came and went shopping, they would sometimes make an offering. And often it was like, they thought it was sort of a little ritual we were doing, so sometimes they'd give like chocolate bars, which we would always appreciate, but we actually like rice would be really nice. We can't live on chocolate. We'd have this drawer full of chocolate bars and like, we need some like sustenance here. this is actually like our food. Yeah.
I can't help but imagine that you were my size when you started this. Three or four years eating like that, you must have lost a lot of weight.
No, you know, actually, we ate really well. We didn't have so much choice what we got, but we never were hungry. We always had food.
But it was just, more just a simple diet.
It was simple, and sometimes it would be like the same thing for three meals in a row. Like, it would be, we just have rice, for example. But there was, and we also, at some point we discovered there's this fruit stand, these Guatemalan brothers, that I think is still there. We would walk from Whole Foods all the way along Miller Avenue, I think, to the, like where, CVS, kind of like Tennessee Valley Road.
Is that right over the bridge?
Yeah.
You see, you go over the bridge, yeah. They have trail mix and fruits.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one, yeah. So that would be like the corner of our walk. And then we walk back other trails to No Abode. It was really like amazing. This town was like is so beautiful, because we'd be like out in nature, and we'd spend the whole, on that day, we would usually, there's a ritual of chanting the sutras at the temple gate, and then you go walk in silence, and you really treat it like walking meditation. It's a day of silent walking meditation, and walking in line, standing silently with the bowl, standing meditation for some hours, and then walking, doing basically a loop of the of Mill Valley. Kind of an all-day thing, and you're exhausted when you get back. But this fruit stand, we found out that there's a certain day when they just get rid of their like overripe produce. They can't sell it, and so we kind of explain what we're doing. Again, we'd be very careful never to ask, but more just like how we would word things. Like, we're doing this experiment, and this is how we're supporting ourselves, and we're doing this so we can do the focus on meditation practice. And it's not just for ourselves. It might look that way, but because of we're doing this, we have to make the temple completely open. You know, it's not just like, you can give us this, but you can't come. It's like, no, you are like, this is universal giving, receiving thing here. It's really beautiful, I think. And people did come. And you could stay, and, you know. And you know, if you want to bring some food, especially because, like, if you come for a sesshin, there might not be enough food for the whole sesshin. So, you know, you don't have to, but you're welcome to bring some. Sometimes that would happen, and it would be really good that it did. And for a while, we had somebody heard what we were doing, and he was a Zen practitioner, and he worked at Green's restaurant, but lived in Mill Valley. So he worked like the late shift, and you know, this is how our society works. It's like, there's so much abundance of leftover food that gets thrown away all over the place every day. And so Greens has this like all this extra food, and they give it to the employees, but the employees can't use it all. So he would, after they took all theirs and the rest was going to be thrown away, he'd gather it up on his motorcycle, and he'd like 3 a.m. or sometime when he'd get back, just before we woke up in the morning, he would drop it on our doorstep many, many days. This went on for about a year until he stopped working for Greens. And the Greens years at No Abode were years of plenty. We'd come down, it'd still be hot. It'd be like hot polenta, or still warm. And we'd just heat it up for breakfast. But it made the Tenzo job quite interesting too, because you couldn't plan any meals. It was just whatever was there at the time. And it wasn't exactly Tenzo. It was like 3 of us. Often there are a member. For a long time, there were 4 people living there. And we just had this rotation of like, what was it like? Yes, there were 3 positions each day. The Doan, who was basically the Doan, the Fukudo, the Kokyo, and did some of the other kind of like, answered the phone if it rang, maybe some other like, sort of like, take care of the temple kind of thing. The breakfast cook and the lunch cook, and then kind of like, no special position, no special duties that day. So that was the 4 positions for the 4 people. Each day we would rotate. And I guess I was the only priest, so I would be Doshi, unless I was the Doan. And, or if I was the breakfast. No, actually breakfast, we had Soji. And during Soji, it's just a few people, so they cook breakfast in like 20 minutes. And, but about Takohatsu was one of the amazing, wonderful practices. And people got to know us because we did it every week. So people in the town, sometimes we'd skip a week for sesshin or something. They're like, we missed you guys, where were you? And some traditional, like, there was a Thai family that lived right on Shoreline Highway there, and they would see us sometimes, and they got to inviting us in. They caught us as we were coming by. Come to our house, and they would give us lemonade and make an offering, because in Thailand, you know, you invite the monks in for a meal or something. And people would stop in their cars and sometimes hand a bag of food or something out the window. And we have a verse. The traditional verse in Japan is when somebody gives the offering, you say alms and dharma, or dharma and material gifts both given. Like, you say, what kind of dharma are we giving here? I think the understanding is just being here and giving your life to practice is the dharma, and you're reminding people that that's happening. So that's, you're giving dharma, and they're giving something to sustain that. It doesn't matter what your practice is. Alms and dharma both giving unsurpassed merit and virtue. Dana paramita, completely fulfilled, I think is the verse. Or sometimes we just say, may your generosity bring you peace and harmony. Almost like, give the merit back to them. And often people would say, it just did. It just has. It already has. My generosity has already given me happiness. And we for the Guatemalan brothers, we even learned the verse in Spanish. How is that? I don't think I can remember it. But and so one story, various, you know, in the Zen koan, sometimes you see stories happen on these alms rounds. Various adventures would happen along the way. We'd have interactions, dharmic interactions. It'd be like, you know, we'd be cooped up in the temple all day, and I think it was a really healthy thing if we just stayed in that building without leaving. It's just like, we get too stale. So this was like, let's go into town, like, bring our practice there, but really keep, like it's really felt like a meditation practice. And we'd bring a bag of lunch and have silent lunch somewhere in town. And, but we'd have all these spontaneous interactions with people who were either practitioners, which there's lots of in Mill Valley, or like kind of pseudo practitioners, and people just checking us out. Hey, how's your enlightenment going? All kinds of questions, you know. And it really felt like we were tested, you know. But the story's getting long. But yes.
So I heard regarding your time at Nobo and regarding Takahashi while living at Nobo, I heard this rumor of an adult nature that somebody one time when you guys were on Takahashi, somebody gave
don't say. Let me tell the story. One time on Takahashi, we people, as they sometimes would, would just stop in their car as we're walking with their balls. They just pull over, and you know, somebody would get out and give us something and bow and get back in their car and go. Happened quite often because we'd be walking along the roads, and one time a group of young men stopped and gave it. It was like a little box of mints. Oh, nice. And they, you know, very sincerely offered, bowed, and like, may your generosity bring you peace and harmony. Well, kind of unusual. They gave us some breath mints. And so all kinds of random stuff we'd sometimes get. Then I forget which of us got it, but one of us got it, and we were walking, and, you know, a few minutes later, they opened the box, and it wasn't breath mints. It was big, green, sticky buds Ganja. Very fresh smelling marijuana. And I thought, I wonder if this has ever happened in the history of Takuhatsu or alms round in any country. Maybe. But it could be the first. Maybe you need to be doing this in California for this to happen. So, whoa. And that's like, and that's quite a bit there. They really, like, that was a very kind offering, but you know, we're doing this monastic life, you know, this, I think the three of us or so who are walking, we're sort of, wow! And we're like, but we, you know, we just got to get rid of it because we can't, this is a Zen temple. We can't have this around. And one of the guys was like, well, okay, of course, yeah, we won't smoke it. We won't use it now. But like, you know, I'm here for a few more months. I'll just like save it till afterwards. I'm like, we don't even bring it in the temple. We don't even want this on the temple grounds. And he's like, well, I'll bury it outside. Like, nah. He was totally adamant, you know. He's like, we're not just going to let this go to waste. Smell it! So, what to do? So we get back to the to No Abode Hermitage. And there's the tradition in Japan, all your food offerings, you put up in front of the altar. You offer it to Buddha first at Bukokuji, where I practiced. It's beautiful, formal temple, but there was always all these like cardboard boxes of food all piled up in front of the altar because there the people would donate. Almost like you offer it to Buddha and then you take it away later. We'd leave it for like a day. And we put the little mince tin on the altar and I said, oh, how about for evening service? We'll offer a little bit of it in the kobako, the incense burner on the charcoal, just symbolically. Oh, okay. So then, evening service time comes on the doshi, and that guy who really wanted to keep it was the doan, stranded at the bell, So we're doing service, and we put it out. We open the box next to the burning charcoal, right? And every time we go forward, offer some. And then the idea arose in my mind, like, there's no way I'm going to get this guy to get rid of this. So the only way we can get rid of it is, this is my only chance. We'll just keep offering it till it's all burnt up. So instead of just a little pinch, big pinch, each time go forward on that charcoal, clouds of smoke filling the Buddha hall. I'm like, you know, we would chant a couple chants, kept going forward, and like there's just a little left, at the last bit, last of it goes on the charcoal. Phew, did it.
Maybe the offering wasn't the first time, but I bet doing it that way was.
yeah, during service in the kobako, maybe so, yeah. And at this time it was too late, but the doan enjoyed the humor of it and actually didn't really mind that it was gone because it was such a novel experience. And then the Buddha hall was completely filled with thick pot smoke. And I just, you know, for a while, I thought, if my teacher comes now, this is going to be really bad. There's nothing we can do, even with the windows open. But that's one of the stories from Takuhatsu, an unusual day. Yeah, so I spent almost a year in Japan before that, where I learned this Takuhatsu practice. So we really and get the feeling of it. You know, you can read like how you do it and the ritual part, but there's a feeling behind it. And we do every week there, and so and it's, I think it was it's a really sweet day in the monastery on those days, because you similarly, because you go out into town, and you at Bukokuji we go to different towns. We'd actually sometimes drive or take a train to different places, and so you see all this rural countryside of Japan in these different, usually little villages, sometimes bigger towns too, often just little farming villages where they have like 10 houses, and you just go to those 10 houses, and then you have to walk through many rice fields to get to another little village. And but those would be where the people would be most devout. It's like the older generation where especially these, you know, farming women, often I think because of their farming culture and maybe their diet, sometimes their backs would be like bent perpendicular. They'd walk like this, very short, you know, women, but they'd still be out in the rice fields, you know, 70s, 80s maybe. And if they come to the form in Japan, we decided not to go door to door in America because people don't know this custom, and it's, even though it's not asking, it's a little too much. We felt we just walk along the road in America. Sometimes we would go to a Japanese restaurant door. You don't knock. Even in Japan, you don't knock. You just start chanting the Enmeijuku Kanengyo outside the door with a bell. And if they hear it, they can come out if they want. But they don't have. If they're inside, they don't even have to come, because they know it's not just their friend. It's not the doorbell, right? They know it's a monk on Takuhatsu. But usually people come if they're there. And then sometimes those little older women, most devout, get down on their knees, you know, so, so happy that there's this practice is still happening and that they can make an offering. Or some parents would give to their kids. There's a little, a young kid. They give coins or rice or something. You give it to them. Learn this practice of giving. Very beautiful. So it's a little different flavor in Mill Valley, but we never went home with an empty bowl. Also, at this time, actually, I already knew Shoho. I think you all know Shoho, my partner. She was a priest at this time. We're both very into this monastic kind of life. She was living at another Zen center in the city. We were already friends, but I remember one time she came to No Abode. I think when it was just me there. I remember it was just the two of us there. We were just monastics. We'd sit across the room from each other. But I remember we had trouble following the schedule completely, because we just loved to talk about Dharma and practice, and we would just, where there was a evening discussion time, and we're just talking and talking, like, oh, we missed the whole period of Zazen. And one time, and she would do this Takuhatsu practice in San Francisco, and one time I went and joined her there, and we walked around San Francisco with the bowl to farmers markets and so on. Many less offerings than Mill Valley. So, there's maybe not any time for any like Zazen instructions. It seems like a story day. I hope this is, at least it kept you awake. And I don't know if there's any value in describing all this, but it's just a little snippet of one person's wish to practice zazen, to practice like this. And the joy of living very simply like this, and if we're doing it for a couple of days or a week of sesshin, very much this memories of no abode come to me often in sesshins like this, because very much like our life here this week. Yes.
You may not readily see the value, but I think for a lot of us, it's a glimpse into your journey.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of your life, and it's a piece of practice, and it's integrating a different culture into this culture, which we don't see that much of.
Yeah.
And so I think it also made me think that living that way, even though it was very simple, it makes me appreciate more the plenty that we have. You know, we live in such actual luxury, even when we don't have a lot of money, we just have everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that kind of contrast helps you to appreciate all that we do have.
Yeah.
Including the temple, including our friendships, including our food, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's, like I said, it's a glimpse into your journey, but then it's also a way of us being able to appreciate more of what we have that we don't always look at or don't always appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a nice opening to see more clearly.
Yeah, and what's really important, you know, if it's really a life based on enjoying the present moment with whatever that includes, the present moment is so abundant. And you know, it might sound like that was like a real struggle to be so simple for me, but like I really didn't feel. I mean, that was part of why I wanted to try the experiment. It really didn't feel like lacking. Maybe at first there was a little transition, but in general, it felt abundant. I think if we weren't getting enough food and we were actually hungry, that would be, I think, a different matter. But there was, you know, we didn't get to choose what it was exactly, but there was always enough. And always enough, you know, as far as like lack of entertainment and this kind of thing too, it also felt like always enough. It just, you know, there was always something to do, and there was nature to explore, and zazen. And community. I mean, there was the last few months at No Abode, I was alone there. It became truly a hermitage. And I really enjoyed that time too. And I didn't feel really cut off because I would go to Green Gulch. It was actually, it was one of my favorite times there. Really simple, focused practice. But that small community that we had there, we'd have our stuff, we'd have our difficulties living together like that, this two or four of us. But it was, that became its own practice. And we generally, I think, made deep bonds. One of those guys who lived there for maybe a year, half a year or a year, I've gotten back in touch with recently, and we do Skype, Dokusan. And he's totally into practice still, and he's on the East Coast, but in his own way, his own kind of personal practice. And being able to, I think that sharing the space, being like, we don't have much, whatever comes, it comes from however it comes, and but whatever we have, we share it with everybody, too. It's not like, oh, finally I got something, like, nobody else. It's more like, it's just freely coming and going. So that as a meditation practice, it had that feeling too of we just receive what comes, and we give what's around, and we trust. I think part of what made it work is there was some inspiration from Dogen Zenji. He in the Zui Monkey, he has many places where he talks about, he says, this is how actually monks should live, and you shouldn't actually, don't worry about your livelihood, don't plan anything for tomorrow, just don't store up food until you're out of it. And if you don't have any, then go get some, or, you know, find some somehow, but don't stockpile. And I really felt like and he says, you can do this if you just trust the way, if you just trust and just practice wholeheartedly. And if you practice wholeheartedly, everything will be taken care of. You can say, that's stupid. There's no logic in that. And I think there isn't any logic in it. But in fact, I think that's a key thing, though. It's like maybe different from don't practice wholeheartedly and just trust. It's more like you just want to practice wholeheartedly. You just want to be really present and open and practice zazen and give your life to the way like that. Then I still have this trust. Everything will be taken care of. It really will. I think partly because of those years, I really feel like everything will be just fine. Just fine might be like we maybe don't, you know, have so much, but still everything will be just fine. But if we're not practicing and then we don't have much, then maybe it's not fine. Because we could even say practicing wholeheartedly means everything is just fine. It means practice the mind of everything is fine. Whatever comes, comes. Whatever goes, goes. I let go and entrust myself to the bowl of this universe.
Fear?
Fear. What about it?
What was the experience of fear, if there was any fear?
I think partly because I was quite healthy. I didn't get sick much during that time, and so around like the health insurance part, I didn't I wasn't too concerned. I still have hardly ever been to a doctor, so I think if I had that issue, I think that would have been there more. At some point, age is going to catch up with me. I know it's coming. We'll deal with that when it comes. but there wasn't, because was there fear? I remember like the food thing that after the first couple of days, it always worked out. There wasn't really fear around that. I think there was. I think, yeah, there might have been smaller fears too, but I think maybe the dominant fear during that time was like the fear that I wouldn't be able to realize the way. That I would be like practicing this way and just be like stuck in my own stuff. Anyway, yeah, it's funny because like it didn't seem, you know, these things weren't such issues at that time. If I had to go back and do it now, it might be hard. Like my life's much more comfortable now, and. Yeah, I don't know. I think it would just be like I think it would be like a transition. I mean, I could go do that now, right? So occasionally I think of it. In fact, no abode is still there. Maybe somebody you have been. Yeah. So, but nobody's, since I left in like 2003 maybe, there's been some caretakers, but nobody's lived there as like a full-time practice place. So it remains, it could, I don't know, Tenshin Roshi's heart, what he has, his long-range visions, but it's a huge, for a hermitage, it's a huge house, you know, like 6 or 8 people could probably live there pretty comfortably. Maybe not 8. 6, I think, pretty well. And it's just empty.
Except for
once a month, 1 day sitting. And by the way, if anybody would like to go up some time from here for a 1 day sitting, when the schedule works out, I like to go. So I think this month was 1 day that I'm thinking of possibly going. Did you have a question?
No, I was just going to say, stories, experiences, experiments like this, I think are and hearing about them are extremely valuable because we hear so much about Shakyamuni Buddha and Bodhidharma and Dogen and even up to Suzuki Roshi. But really, like, as practitioners practicing in such a way, I'm like, hey, that's great, but what about today? I frequently think that with regards to practice, well, past months of priests and practitioners, well, what about today? What about today?
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing today? What is anybody doing today? People are doing today. People are still doing it. It might in fact be, or I think it definitely is harder to practice that way today than it was however long ago. Because I think the general distance between your average person's life and the monastic life has gotten wider and wider and wider and wider as industrial societies have developed and certain levels of standard of living. It just gets farther, the two get farther and farther away, so it gets more and more difficult to commit to a lifestyle like that, but it's still...
Well, in some ways, I think it's also it's more difficult because our culture, it's something strange to our culture. Even in modern Japan, which is a lot like modern America, it's in their culture understands that life for so many centuries. However, that was part of the experiment that I found is that, like, even though it's very unusual in our culture can understand it. Even if they don't know it as, oh, it's this traditional Japanese thing or Buddhist thing, like these Guatemalan brothers were the great example because they knew nothing about Buddhism. But we explained what we were doing. They knew it was some kind of spiritual thing. And I think they were spiritual Christians. And they were so into it. They were so happy to see us. We missed you if you didn't come. And so there's something so universal about just living simply and trying to train one's mind that it is somewhat understandable. And in some ways, I think it may be easier than Dogen's time when they had this famine in Japan and they would do takohatsu and they'd go, like, people are like, we'd like to give you something, but we only have this much rice, you know? Whereas here, it's like, there's such abundance in America, we didn't ever have to go hungry. It's just a matter of finding ways that things come. And there's support in general, and I don't know if it's easier or harder, actually.
Can I just think about, in Dogen's time or wherever, you know, dealing with the elements.
Yeah, yeah.
Something as simple as cooking.
Mm.
You know, you have to make a fire. And
yeah.
Or getting water, you know, gathering water.
Yeah, yeah.
Living in this house.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. You
know, turn,
yep.
Turn on.
Yep. And then the utilities, gas and electric, I think how it worked was that we, in Japan, they can receive money as well as food in the bowl. In fact, it's Japan, it's mostly people give coins and stuff, or dry, uncooked rice in your bag. In Southeast Asia, they just, because they don't use money, they just receive food. So we receive food and money, and the monetary offerings ended up being enough to pay for like the gas and the electric in this place. So it really covered just that 1 week, once a week trip into town sustained the practice place basically through that time.
And
no boat.
Oh, so you did receive money.
Yeah. We discussed that, like maybe we shouldn't, and they're like, well, if in Japan it's okay, then and we do need to pay the utilities somehow, then, but we won't use that money for food. We did decide that. We'll just use that for utilities, and end up being just about the right amount, and the food is the food. And I should also say that Green Gulch, down the road, actually greatly supported us in that they, food-wise, they have, you know, they can serve their leftovers, but then as a institution, you can't serve leftovers a second time. There's health codes about that. So they have to compost the second round of leftovers. So we gladly received them, the compost. Maybe once or twice, remember, like, it was too late and finding it, in, actually kind of trying to scoop it out of the compost buckets. I probably would have stayed on, and maybe I would still be there. But Tenzin Roshi, my teacher, whose place it was, really, it was, you know, it was his, and still is, his monastery, and it's more like, even though he wasn't there, really, during those years, he's like, but this was the idea, it would be like a place for people to live and practice. He was going to lead the practice period of Tassajara, and he still does with his priests, especially more newly ordained priests. He's like, they have to be with me wherever I am. So like, I'll only go to Tassajara if they can come with me. He tells the Zen Center authorities, and like, well, it's going to be hard because they have all these positions at Green Gulch. They're living with him at Green Gulch, and like, it's going to be hard to run Green Gulch if you take all of them away. It's like, oh, I won't go then. He drives these hard bargains. Okay, no, we really want you to go. So if they can go, we'll work it out. And that's when he said, Green Gulch is like having some problems now with me going and taking people away. So would you mind, just while I'm gone for practice period, could you come help out in the Green Gulch kitchen? And then, and then I can come back to Nobo, right? And say, oh yeah, of course. So, that's what happened. But so then I went, and then I had like a different world of view. And I was like living in this totally different environment, and, which I, you know, when I was at No Abode, I was somewhat critical of, in a somewhat arrogant kind of way. And And then when I got there, then it's just that was my life. And then like I think offers started coming to like, oh, we actually need an Eno at Green Gulch. And I thought this, as a priest, this would be a really good training opportunity to be an Eno, right? So I'm there. It's, you know, it's quite involved. It's like, you know, you set up all the sashins and all the everything basically that involves the zendo. So it's like one of the greatest jobs because you're just in the zendo all the time. Your job is to like never miss zazen, and then between zazen you're just like organizing retreats and things. So I'm like, well, that is a good opportunity. It might not arise again. So okay, I'll do it for a year. And that was the end of Noble Abode. Because 1 year turned into a few years and other things, and then like come to Tassajara, I go to Santa Cruz, and da 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 da. And here we are. It was a beautiful time though in my practice life. I think of very fondly those years. We would draw because it was so open. We would draw a certain homeless element, homeless practitioners, because it's a free place to stay, and never just random homeless people, but people with practice, and some just amazing people. One guy who still, I think lives in a cave in Utah, and he would, very devout Christian, trying to live the way of Jesus completely. So he also, like, a vow not to use money for many years. And, but he liked traveling and adventure, so he would hitchhike all around the country with no particular destination, just wherever people would take him, and really got this for over years, got to see many, many places and learn many different spiritual practices. And so he stayed there for a while. And a Tibetan monk, young Tibetan monk, maybe my age, but who was born in Tibet and somehow ended up in California and needed a place, he lived there for months. That was one of the great things. He was a Nyingma monk, so he was in the Dzogchen tradition. And, you know, spoke English well, too. And, but very traditionally trained. So long conversations comparing Zen and his Tibetan path and the different types of practices that he'd learned. So sweet, you know, he would join our practice.
One of the things I remember Isho saying one of the times when I saw him was one of the great gifts that the West has given to the Dharma and to Buddhism is all these different traditions coming together. You know, when he lived in Pioneer Valley, Theravada monks would come and stay with him there, and Tibetan monks would stay with him there, and they would have these same things where they would talk about the differences and the similarities of their traditions. He said, if I had just stayed in Japan and just practiced in my Zen tradition, I would have never had any of those experiences, or there would have been much less
conflict. In any one of those Asian countries, it's a whole system in and of itself, but there's very little cross-fertilization. America's California is amazing like that.
So this was Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
The way he put it, that this is what the West has given already.
We had other Tibetan teachers. There was somebody there, her Tibetan teacher came and stayed, and Adon Amaro, great Theravada monk who's now the abbot at Amaravati in England, he he came and had tea with us there, and yeah, a lot of interesting, actually, people came through. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.